Skyline Studio, excited to be here, right? Right? We're getting into 2024 in a big way, and in for John Landecker. He'll be back with us. There's been some controversy. Brendan, you could probably, you know, he may be slightly under the weather, but he is a big Michigan guy, and that game is happening right now. And so who knows what he's recuperating, right? Hopefully to a national championship for the Michigan Wolverines. In studio with me, we'll have David Hammond. He is going to be in for an eclectic blend of guests. We're going to talk a little bit about some of Chicago's delicacies. He is, of course, the author of Made in Chicago, Stories Behind 30 Great Hometown Bites. David, welcome.
Hey, Dane. Good to see you again.
It's good to see you, too. And it's good to talk about some of these things. Plus, you'll have a little surprise in your bag of of culinary tricks.
Kind of a big news for Chicago original foods. Yeah.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Then coming up, maybe after about 8:15 or so, Lou Bank is going to join us, a mutual friend of ours. Yep. And he is going to... Now, he is... He's kind of like a Renaissance man, right? You know, he's a sort of bon vivant, but he travels. But his wheelhouse is, of course, support and advocacy for the world of mezcal.
Yeah, and the people who make mezcal. I mean, he does a lot for the little communities that make the mezcal, the people who grow the plants and then do the distilling and bottling and so on. He helps them by building libraries and water reclamation systems. Did you have him on after Thanksgiving? Did that work out?
I did. You were traveling. You were in between. You were in between places because, believe this, and for the listeners who David and Lou Banks spend Thanksgiving in Mexico. I guess you can get thanks from wherever, right?
Yeah, it was. That's the second year we've done that. It's we brought some more family members this time and had a bunch of people, guests from Mexico City, friends of Lou, come by, and it was really fun. We have the turkey. We have mole, you know, a Mexican sauce on the turkey, which kind of makes sense. Turkey mole is a classic Mexican dish. Some incredible tortillas, and everybody brings stuff. Carolyn made cornbread stuffing. Cornbread because it's gluten-free and Lou is avoiding gluten. It was so good. I knocked a bowl of it onto the floor and it broke.
And you felt actual
people
sorrow.
People were eating it off the floor.
That is a joke. That is not true.
Ask Lou. Ask Lou if he wasn't one of those guys doing that. Well, it was that good.
Well, there may be food insecurity issues in the area where you were, right? Where that would be.
Well, it was a home kitchen, so you know we can do whatever.
Wow. Okay, so a little bit back on that for the holidays. Was it hard for you to source? I know we're talking Thanksgiving stuff, but hey, was it hard for you to source a lot of the things?
Not really. I mean the. Turkeys were indigenous to Mexico, to all of North America, so those are easy enough to get. And all the like cornmeal, you know, they have a lot of corn in Mexico too, so that wasn't hard to get for the stuffing we made. And Lou, of course, provided abundant mezcal and tequila, some really cool stuff. And just like Thanksgiving at home, everyone brought something, but it was a little different and more fun because my grandkids were there and my daughter and her family. And
really?
My buddy from college, my best man at my wedding came with his family.
What?
Yeah,
was this sort of just a coincidence? I know the family, obviously, you knew that, but did you run into some friends down there?
No, we didn't. These are all people who we planned to go to Mexico with. They wanted to come along. I think Mexico City's become kind of a hip place to go. I mean, I've been going there since like the 80s sometimes, but it seems like it's become an attractive, relatively local foreign destination. It's on Central, Mexico City is on Central Time, so you don't even have to change time zones.
Right.
And it's like 3.5-4 hours to get there, about as long as it takes to get to California.
Surprisingly close, right? It feels, at least it does to me, and I think to a lot of listeners, it feels like it's a world away.
Yep.
But it's a lot closer than even, let's say, going to California. You and I, earlier this last year, you know, we went to Guadalajara. We got a chance to go to El Viejito and check out the distillery there. And I was kind of surprised how close it really was, because you feel like, you know, you're going to, you know, it's another country. Of course, it's Mexico. But it's surprisingly close and super accessible. We'll talk about that in addition. Plus, of course, the book, and congratulations on all the success.
Thanks a lot.
I have to say,
well.
I have to put that, you know, kind of stake in the North Pole of some of the first times that you had even thought about you were going to write the book. You and I were talking about it on these airwaves here.
Oh, I think
WGN.
I introduced it on one of your shows.
You were just like, hey, we're going to do this crazy thing. And obviously, as a food person myself, and you and I in and around a lot of that, it was super interesting. But I didn't know that the world would find it just as it. I mean, the reception has been amazing.
Certainly, the world of Chicago. We've done over 30 presentations in Chicago, and the response has been I don't want to say surprising, because that means it's like we didn't know it was going to be good. We thought it was going to be good. But the warmth of people's responses, too, and they come up after the presentation to just tell us how much they loved it, and it was great hearing about where the Italian beef sandwich came from. These are foods people have been eating all their lives. So when we go into the history of it, that resonates. I mean, they can relate to that. They want to know, where did that Chicago hot dog come from?
The 312-981-7200. Throughout the course of the program, David will be in studio with us the entire time. If you want to share one of yours, either one of maybe some thought process, some experiences with some of the indigenous delicacies, the Chicago foods that he has highlighted, or, and I'm sure this has happened, where, let's say there's a follow-up book, there's got to be more than people said, hey, next time, you got to include this.
Yeah, and we found two things. In fact, I'd like to talk about those tonight, two items that are not in the book. Relatively recent developments, but that qualify by our definition of Chicago original food.
So like a next generation?
Yeah. This was their second edition, yeah.
Okay. So, but this isn't maybe an unexplored or undiscovered thing from way back. This is something maybe more recent? That
One is more recent. The other is an ancient beverage that's been resurrected in Chicago.
Wow, we're going to do this. So we're going to be all over the world tonight. We're going to actually break down a little bit of Bears-Packers. We're going to have Jim Bob Morris, who ties in a lot of the things, not only with the distillery in Mexico and being one of the founders of El Bandito Yankee, but also the Jim Bob Show here on WGN. And, of course, we were up at the Bears-Packers game at Lambeau Field. And so a little bit of, you know, some hope for the future. Of course, the Bears have a big draft pick, but maybe a little disappointment, right? The season didn't go as well as people may have hoped. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk with the one and only Lou Bank. He is going to join us, and we're going to talk about Sacred, his concern, his, you know, it's a foundation, right? And where he does, and as David mentioned, helps out in all those significant ways. So keep it here. It's Dane on 720. WGN 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you, along with acclaimed author David Hammond. He is in studio, and he's also a mutual friend of our next guest. And you know, there's people out there in the world that have just done some cool things. You know, whether it's his support of the dog world, the animal world, his work with Marvel, right? It doesn't get any cooler than that, or that higher purpose stuff that he does in the world and in the name of those great families working in the name of Mezcal down in Mexico. It is the one and only Lou Bank. Lou, welcome to WGN.
Hey, how you doing, Dane?
I am good, and we've got our mutual friend.
Hey, Lou.
David Hammond.
Hey, he is not a friend of mine. If you spend Thanksgiving with a guy for more than 3 years, it's family.
Oh.
David Hammond is my brother.
Thank you. Gracias, senor.
Gracias. Okay, so we'll do the 23andMe on you guys a little bit later. But one of the things he mentioned, and I mean, I think it was a great testament to the potential taste quality of the mole sauce, but he had said that it was so good that it got knocked over.
The cornbread stuffing.
It was the cornbread stuffing that had got knocked over. And, you know, it was more than a five-second rule. It was a forever rule, and people made their way to the ground in order to enjoy it.
Oh, yes. People were eating great stuffing and great ceramic wood, which you find all over Mexico. It's just most people, when they eat it up, they don't mean they literally eat it up, but that's what you do sometimes.
You know, I think it's important, though, even just to share your guys' experience and the way that you guys love and experience not only the foods, but the people of Mexico. It kind of takes it and puts it in just a broader category. I mean, I think that a certain amount of people, you think of it as a vacation destination. You think of it maybe as a cuisine, right, that you love and enjoy here. But there's so much more to it, especially as David had mentioned, you know, Mexico City, right, has been sort of redefined. I mean, you think you know kind of what it is. In my mind, here's what I think when I first hear, I think big, bustling, just giant in the middle of
biggest
the country.
City in North America.
Yeah, just absolutely huge. But I don't know if people know either how accessible it is or really what a great place it is to visit.
And they seem to like us.
That sounds like an ad campaign. Mexico
they
City.
They seem to like
they
us.
They seem to like us. Is that true, Lou, or are they just like you guys?
I can't say whether they like me or not, but they treat me awfully well when I'm down there, at least what seems well to me. Mm-hmm.
Well, part of the reason is I think that you kind of pay it back and forward in a bunch of ways and sharing your support for them. I know you've got a couple things coming up. We want to talk in the overview perspective for Sacred, something that's been near and dear for a long time, and some of the things that are happening and certainly ways that people can get more information and get involved. But then you've got some near future specific events and initiatives that are on the front burner.
Yeah. You know, so when every year as Giving Tuesday hits, just after Thanksgiving, of course, the nonprofit world kicks into high gear for fundraising. And the campaign we've been focusing on since then is trying to preserve this endangered language, right? There's this barometer. I want to say it's when fewer than 100,000 people speak a language, it's considered at risk of disappearing. And this language, Ixcatec, which is spoken primarily, or was spoken primarily in this community of Santa Maria Ixcatlan, Oaxaca, this language, they think there's fewer than 900 people who speak it now.
Hmm.
Somebody told me that they thought it was actually down to 9, and I find that really hard to believe. But, you know, whether it's 900 or it's 9, it's an endangered language. And one of the Mescalero families that I'm friends with down there has asked if we could help them raise funds to build this school/library in order to preserve the language, to start, instead of watching it disappear as people who do speak it, you know, pass away, instead trying to get some of the younger kids in town to learn the language and try and expand the speakership, I guess you would call it, of that language. So that's one of our primary focuses right now.
And maybe go out with tape recorders and start capturing how this language is spoken by living people in case those 9 people aren't with us in the next 10, 20 years. They have a record of how it was supposed to sound by people who grew up with it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, David. You know, I've never even thought about capturing the sound of it. I've been looking at the written language lately. Yeah, right?
No, but that is so important, just the way that it sounds, the inflections. And your thoughts on it, Lou, the value of it, obviously there's a historical connection that people have. And is it Spanish as a dialect? And then specifically because maybe in that language they have ways to uniquely describe things that are important to them that you just don't find in other languages.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, when we talk about preserving culture, I mean, the very foundation of culture is language, the way that you describe the things that are around you, that you live with, the people that you live with, right? That's all embedded in language. And so when a language dies, I mean, yeah, you can preserve parts of the culture, but the foundation of that culture is gone. So this is a pre-Hispanic language. This is a language they spoke before the Europeans ever, you know, crashed the party here in Mesoamerica. They've got the written version of it, but of course, before there was a written version, there was that spoken version. So you're right, David. Like part of what they're doing with the library is capturing the print, but I'm pretty sure once you suggest that to a Mondo and family, that they'll be all over it because that tool exists in town right now.
Could you say the name of that language again, Lou?
Sure, it's Ixcatec. So it's Ixcatec, and the name of the town is Santa Maria Ixcateco. And in fact, you know, this family has started a line of agave spirits, uncertified agave spirits, called Ixcateco. That also reflects another part of that culture of the community, because they have their own processes for making the spirits. And the thing that most Mezcal geeks talk about when they're talking about this community is that they're fermenting the agave in the skin of a bull. It's literally this sort of pouch that hangs between 4 logs. So it's, you know, the fact that they've got this carryover from literally hundreds of years ago that they're still using this process of fermentation.
Does that bullskin add anything like, flavor wise or any other way?
You can taste the bull.
Oh, so many people when I share it with them, they say, "Oh, it tastes to me like leather." But I think that might also just be when you say to somebody,
"Sure,
it's, you know, yeah, this." Right. I think they start to taste those things. Mm-hmm. You know, it everything I've had that's been made in this community using that process, I love it. But I find so much variance from one expression to the other. And I'm sure it's adding something. My guess is, more than anything, it's becoming this environment. The Bullskin itself becomes an environment in which these wild yeasts and other bacteria live, but they might not survive, right? So I'm sure it's affecting it that way, but probably more so that than the flavor of the skin itself.
Yeah, I mean, but so many different things and elements involved there. And Lou, and I know we've got maybe about 3 minutes left, and I want you to be able to give the listeners an overview on Sacred, a little bit about sort of the unique relationship on the mezcal side that is different than the tequila side in the way that the families utilize, you know, and your support to help support them in what it is that they do on just a totally different kind of scope and scale than you see on the tequila world.
Well, you know, I think it's a little unfair to dismiss tequila in that way. And I think it's also similarly unfair to build up mezcal on the other side of that equation. You know, so both tequila and mezcal are denominations of origin. And all that means is that each of them have these regulatory bodies that say, this can be called tequila, or this cannot be called tequila. But the rules that they follow, there are differences. But the rules that they follow allow for the same kind of traditions to be carried over from hundreds of years ago. It's just the vast majority of tequila is made in an industrial way. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of mezcal right now is made in a pre-industrial way. But I can show you industrial mezcal, and I can show you some pre-industrial examples of tequila. You know, to me, the thing that I love so much about these communities in Mexico is, so frequently I'll find these families and whole networks of families that have this different worldview where they're not focused on efficiency. They're focused on best results. And I think that mindset applied to problems like food insecurity, water insecurity, climate change, I think that mindset can help us develop better solutions to the problems that we're facing than we would be able to develop ourselves.
Yeah, I think in order to kind of approach some of those things, you have to know about them a little bit, and that's one of the things that you're doing and raising awareness with it. And so some of this may sound like a world away, and some of it is. But Lou, before we let you go, give information. I think people can support a local store, right, and then get more, you know, into things and support some of the causes that you're involved with that are coming up.
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's heartwarming to be able to support, like, the school to preserve Ixquetec, right? But you can also warm your belly while you're doing that. If you head over to Off Premise, the liquor store on Armitage, near Halstead, I'm not sure the exact location, but they've got this special limited edition box set of puntas, of a 68% ABV agave spirit that we brought over special as a fundraiser. And in essence, what you're doing really is you're making a donation of $1,000 toward the school. And in thanks, you're going to get 1.5 liters of a spirit that you could only get if you followed me into this little community in Puebla that's way off the beaten path, made by hand by Ildefonso Mastatis. He makes amazing spirits, and you won't taste anything like this.
Well, so Lou, before we let you go, give the website information, social media, so people can find out how to get a hold of you, how to support some of these things that are going on.
Right on. So if you want to support Sacred, please go to sacredagave.org. You can find us on social media at sacredagave. You can go to offpremisechicago.com if you want to get that box set. And, anybody who's interested in having this conversation and helping these communities, you're my kind of people. Let's go have a drink.
Thanks, Lou. Thanks for everything you're doing. Appreciate you jumping on the show today.
Oh, hey, right back at you. Thank you for the
hasta luego, amigo.
To preach the gospel.
All right. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, a little bit more on that, plus Bears and Packers. Jim Bob Morris will join us. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. And as Bear fans are looking forward to the to next year, right? Maybe a great draft pick, maybe, you know, a team that feels like maybe it's kind of where it was last year at this time. A little bit of promise, a little bit of hope, but kind of still in the same spot. A lot of them are just reminiscing on really what was the greatest tailgate. You know, they always say, and Dave Hammond is in studio with us as well, is you may not win the game, but you can always win the tailgate. Jim Bob Morris is with us. Hey, Jim Bob.
Hello, Dane. How are you, partner? What a great day that was yesterday, enjoying that tailgate you're talking about. I mean, talking about a great festive environment with both fan bases there and having a lot of fun and enjoying themselves and having quite a bit of El Bandito Yankee. It was a really fun day.
Yeah, and it seemed like everyone was really getting along. You know, the friendly rivalry, but a lot of camaraderie, a lot of support just as fans, and a lot of hope for the future. You know, unfortunately, you know, for the Bears fans, you know, it is one of those things where, you know, you get that draft pick. I feel like the team was going in the right direction, but at the end of the year, they're kind of where they were last year. And you look at the comparisons between the teams, you look at the Packers, a team that was, you know, less experienced, one of the youngest teams, a quarterback, you know, much less proven than even Justin Fields. And, you know, they're going to be on to the playoffs.
Yeah. You know, there was quite a few takeaways on the game yesterday. I didn't think the score was indicative of the real game. I thought that the Packers, you know, they were like, 7-10 on third down conversions, and they sacked Justin Fields 5 times, and I think Love had 1 sack. I think what I took away from the game is that Jordy Love played, you know, under control, and he was well poised throughout the game. His fumble was unfortunate. That was one of the things that I don't think is as reflective or indicative of the score. But, you know, the Bears failing to get a touchdown in the game, and that's you know, the second time this season that the Bears couldn't muster a touchdown. And you just can't win these games at the end of the year without, you know, scoring a touchdown. I mean, you got to score. And so I thought that. I thought the Bears defense did a pretty good job, you know, on a couple plays, but Jordan Love found ways to connect. I mean, my God, he was, you know, he threw for over 300 yards. I mean, you know, the game was still in question. I mean, even though the score, I mean, you know, if the Bears do score, and I love DJ Moore, I think he's fantastic, but when he's such a dynamic player, you know, I was worried there at the end for the Packers. I mean, they scored 2 points. I mean, the game was still reachable for the Bears.
Yes. It was close the entire time. I mean, there were so many opportunities that I think that both teams had to either do more, score more, be a part of it. I mean, it was in question up until the end, but you don't want to take that much away from Jordan Love. I mean, I'm surprised. Every time they bring these statistics up, I'm shocked, whether it's the statistic that, you know, the year that he had would have been the greatest, you know, year in Bears quarterback history, that, right? Or the fact now they're saying that, you know, the end of the stats is that Jordan Love's, it's the third best quarterback year for a rookie quarterback ever in the NFL.
Well, he passed the 4,000-yard mark as a rookie. I mean, as I said, he played with a lot of poise, I thought. The last 4 games, other than the debacle they had up in New York, I thought Love, you know, played, you know, pretty good. You know, and he's showing, like I said, the chagrin of the Bears fan is, oh no, do we have another, you know, what have we got brewing here? Hopefully not another Hall of Fame quarterback. By the way, my friend of mine was talking when we were talking at the game yesterday, and they go, you know, you should trademark the saying. Let me tell you something, Dane.
Well, but there's a lot to say. And before we get on to the national championship game that is happening as we speak, and I know a lot of people, certainly a lot of Michigan fans, Michigan's alums are right here in the Chicagoland area. So we'll talk about that in a second. But you think about this, you know, and it has happened where wild card teams have come in and found their way to the Super Bowl. And you look at with Aaron Jones, the way that he is running, you look at just the way that they have, even through injuries, been able to discover a lot of great young talent on the receiver side. I think the Packers are a dangerous team. I mean, that would be the team you didn't want to play was maybe the Cowboys at home, but who knows?
Well, and it depends on who gets healthy. You know, I mean, Here we are at the part of the season where injuries matter a ton. And so who's going to be healthy? Who's going to come back? You know, is Watson going to be available? That soft tissue injuries are always a bummer. You know, trying to recover from whether it's an ankle sprain or a hamstring, those are just lingering, you know, injury issues. But we'll see who comes back. I mean, the Cowboys look really dynamic at home. They look fast. They look tough. I mean, they beat up the Philadelphia Eagles at home. I mean, I got to tell you, just beat them up. And so, I don't know. They could be a team that gets into the playoffs. I think that, you know, there's a couple dangerous teams out there. I think the Buffalo Bills are dangerous. I think the Cleveland Browns are people could overlook them. And the Packers may be one of those teams that could be overlooked as well.
When it comes to the national championship, it is happening right now. It is Michigan. It is Washington. You are watching it. I'm not watching it. We're in the studio here. How does it look?
Michigan looks good. Very dominant. You know, Washington, they're gunslingers. You know, they got the score at the end of the half. They're going to be aggressive. They, you know, they get the ball coming out here, you know, in the second half, and we'll see what they do. I mean, that's a dynamic offense against a really good Michigan team. You know, it's going to be a great game, I think. I think that, you know, Washington, you know, they missed a couple of throws to make the game a little tighter. I think that'll get tightened up in the second half. And I think it's going to be an amazing second half. And, you know, I mean, the Washington's been disrespected all year. I mean, you know, they had a game where they were 8.5 or 9 point underdogs to Oregon, a team that they beat previously. And I'm like, well, that's like a gift. And so we'll see what happens, buddy. It's going to be a great game. I'm looking forward to the second half and how things go. And I'm looking forward to, seeing how what happens in the playoffs here. You know, I'm excited about, you know, the Packers, you know, the 4 months of football here, and you get rewarded. Hey, you're going to the playoffs.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. A lot of ways for people to celebrate. I mentioned Dave Hammond when we first introed you. And so Dave Hammond is, you know, acclaimed author and writer and personality on the media side here. And Jim Bob, he has been with us to El Viejito, to the El Bandito Yankee Distiller. He was one of those first guys to be able to taste the Añejo, and he got a chance to interview Karina Rojo. So when that launches in the near future, in the next month or so, Dave will have something to say.
Yeah, no, I was very impressed with that operation. I thought the distiller there, whose name I'm not, was it Rosa?
It's Karina Rojo.
Yeah, Rojo. It was interesting to see a female distiller who committed, knows what she's doing. Cool product.
Yeah, it's one of the stories, Dan, that when I tell the story, I go, listen, we're a lot of years away before we get a woman head coach in the NFL. Okay. I mean, that becoming a master distiller in Mexico, I look into the same type of situation. I mean, it's a very, you know, it's a men dominated industry, and it's pretty macho. And her becoming that's a great story. And we, you know, we try to broadcast that as much as we can. I think it's a great story.
It takes a lot of courage for her too to take that position and fearlessly go forth and make great tequila.
Yeah, and so, you know, when we were traveling around Mexico looking for that right distiller for us that was a fit for us, and you know what I'm talking about. You know, you're traveling through the highlands there, and it's quaint. It's very quaint, and it's rustic, and you come down that first part of that cobblestone road there. It just felt right, you know, going to El Viejito for me, and then meeting with Juan Eduardo and then Karina. It was just a really good feeling, and boy, we've produced, as you know, I mean, that Añejo is going to be world-class Añejo, and got a, you know, 96 rating coming out of the first sips from some of the big-time people,
oh,
so I appreciate you seconded it.
Yep. Yeah, David got a chance to try it. We did too. We're excited about it. We know that people are going to really enjoy that, and there's a great story to tell with all of it. And so, Jim Bob, we'll let you get back to it. And I know for the Jim Bob Show here on WGN, we are going to have a big playoff preview that's going to be coming up, so people should look forward to that this weekend.
Yeah, and we'll go back to our, you know, like I said, we ended up pretty strong in regards to the picks. So, you know, 36-3-1. So I just keep wishing I'd take my own advice, and I would be in the Caribbean right now.
If you could pass some of that advice along to our friend Whitey, pass that advice along.
Well,
let everybody know we're talking about our buddy Whitey. And a shout out to everybody. And hey, thank you guys. Appreciate the conversation tonight. And let's go watch the rest of this national championship. And I'll give you a call back later. I'll talk to you.
All right. Thanks, Jim. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go deep into the indigenous delicacies of Chicago. Made in Chicago, the author, of course, you've been hearing him all night, David Hammond. So we'll be back with that. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you until 10. In studio with me is the one and only, the incomparable, best-selling author, David Hammond.
Hey,
made
Dane.
In Chicago. Think about this. I always talk about it, and I've been covering, you know, food in here, you know, in the city and in and around it, and really an ambassador for, you know, every place I go, I talk about it. It's a great food town, and I always say you can spin the globe and put your finger down and you'll find someone making it at a great, at a really high level here in the Chicago area. But, you know, Chicago's own foods, our own delicacies, often pigeonholed into people like hot dogs or pizza, right? That's what it is.
Yeah, or Italian beef, perhaps. The Chicago is becoming known as a major food city. I mean, it is now known as a major food city. But when people talk about Chicago as a great food city, what they're talking about usually are the James Beard Award-winning restaurants, the restaurants that get Michelin stars, all worthy, all places I'd jump the chance to go have dinner. But there's a lot of small little mom-and-pop places that are making the foods that tens of thousands of Chicagoans eat every day. Many of them are well-known. Like you said, deep dish pizza, Chicago hot dog, Italian beef. Many people outside of Chicago have heard of those things. And when they come to the city, that's what they want. But in our book, this is the book Made in Chicago, Stories Behind 30 Great Hometown Bites. That's by me, David Hammond, and Monica Eng. There's 27 other foods that are that were born in Chicago, are eaten by thousands of people a day, but are virtually unknown in many parts of the city. For instance, the cool stuff they're doing on the south side is not very well known on the north side, like the gym shoe, for instance. Or
well, but maybe some marketing or focus group could help them with descriptive and maybe appetizing names.
Or maybe they just want to keep it small scale and serve their communities. I mean, that could be, you know, the goal of some of these places. So we came up with these 30 foods. We've been touring all last year. We're starting again this year. Going out to libraries with the Newberry Library, the Harold Washington Library, 30 other places, over 30 other places now, where people have come to hear about the foods they've been eating all their lives and many times the food they love. They want to hear the history behind it, why this food turned out that way. And we capped it at 30, but recently a few new foods have come to my attention. Do we want to talk about that
yeah,
now?
Yeah, sure.
Let's... One that I just had for the first time last week.
Now, do you have a vetting process?
Yes.
Like someone comes up just to confirm. Does it have to have like some kind of provenance? Is there like a form someone fills out if they want to submit a new food?
What? No one's ever actually submitted a food to us. I mean, we've hunted them down, and they have to be foods that either were made for the first time in Chicago or were introduced and put on a menu for the first time in Chicago. And they have to be served, to this day, at more than one place. It can't be just like a chef special
right. That's
going to come and go in a week. These have to be foods that, like shrimp Dijon. That was a food that was developed in Chicago, introduced at the 1893 Columbian Exposition. And now you find shrimp Dijon at a lot of high-end restaurants. Even cod Dijon and lobster Dijon. You add breadcrumbs and garlic, olive oil, a little wine. Boom. You got yourself a Dijon.
You got yourself a Dijon.
That's what we call
it. You do gym shoe Dijon.
It hasn't been done yet.
No, it hasn't been done. See, look, it's just a think tank right here.
So, yes, foods that we put in the book had to be served at more than one place and had to have been developed in Chicago. Now, Lee Omolinsky, the bakery chef at Daisy's, is now serving, and I had one for the first time last weekend, although this is offered at least two other bakeries that we found. So you might have heard of this. It's kind of wild. It's a Chicago-style hot dog in a croissant. So you have this, the conjunction of this kind of fancy French pastry and a Chicago hot dog is kind of funny in and of itself, but it turns out to be delicious. And they have, actually, it's a poppy seed croissant, just like the poppy seed bun you get. And it was really very good. They put the mustard and the glow-in-the-dark pickle relish and everything inside the croissant, and the wieners kind of sticking out both ends. It's really quite good. Now, it's also, we found it at... We haven't been to these places yet, but we understand they're serving these at Loaf Lounge and Dan the Baker, too. These are two other bakeries that are taking Chicago hot dogs, putting them in a croissant. Now, Do you think it, can we talk about this?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, this now a revival that I find particularly exciting. We're looking around. We're going to be on Chicago Today tomorrow. We're just going to be taping a show. It's an NBC program. And they wanted to talk about some Chicago foods and drinks, but they didn't want to do Malort again because we were on the show early last year. We did Malort. So I was Googling around. I remembered when I was a kid, I walked by on Madison Street. If you're walking from the train station and you're by the 200 West Block on Madison, there's a big sign that says Home of Cohasset Punch. Home of Cohasset Punch. That means that's where it was born, right? But Cohasset's in Massachusetts. What does that mean? And I was a kid, you know, when I saw this, I didn't know what the heck it meant. I didn't investigate it. But Cohasset Punch is a Chicago drink that had been made since the late 19th century and had been made continuously in Chicago. It stopped production, I think it was 89, they did their last bottle.
Really? So pretty recent.
Pretty recent. And the trademark expired. The company went out of business. They didn't renew their trademark. So this young guy, Greg Shudders. I want to make sure I got that right. Greg Shudders, yeah. Revived the brand. I Googled around looking for Cohasset Punch, and I found a website devoted to Cohasset Punch. I emailed the website, and this guy, Greg Shudders, responded to my question. And he's
how fortunate could he get? Well, he's there toiling in obscurity, and then, like, you're the one guy on the whole planet that would be looking for
it. Yes, it was meant to be. So what Greg has done is he's researched Cohasset Punch, and there's been quite a lot written about it since, like, 1901 and 1902. People are writing cocktail books about Cohasset Punch and including recipes on how you can make it at home. And it has some rather common ingredients like sweet vermouth, lemon juice, stuff like that. But it also requires New England rum, which isn't – I forget the name of the rum. It's Meredith or something like that. Isn't made anymore. So he had actually come up with a recipe that would – simulate the flavors of New England rum. So he's trying now to get his bottles into distribution. He is bottling the stuff. I have a bottle right here in front of me. Maybe Dane will try some.
Yes, we will try some. And I had to ask, you know, off the air before we got on, I said, you know, because Malort is, you know, it's identified with Chicago and there's a certain appeal to it and it has its fans. But, I mean, I got to say, the consensus across the board would be that it's pretty terrible, right? It just happens to be...
Well, it's gotten better. You know, the CH Distillery, which now makes Malort, tweaked the recipe slightly. And
how would you describe it? If you had to describe it, use your describing, like, notes of detecting this. Because here's my thought. It's like kind of an old Band-Aid.
Sure. That, yeah, you know? It gets a lot of... You know, or, yeah, a gym shoe that was dragged through a cow pasture, yeah, or something. It is. I don't think it's that bad. Now, I like Amaros, which are bitter drinks from Italy, and they're kind of, you know, well, like Ferni Branca is an Amaro, and that's kind of a popular drink with the young folks. It's like that. I would not say it was as complex as a lot of those, but a bad flavor? I don't think so. Now, Monica Eng, my co-author, had her first sip of Malort in these studios here, and she hated it at first. I got a picture of her making Malort face. Incidentally, folks, you want a little laugh? Go on Instagram and search hashtag Malort face, and you'll see pictures of people, usually visitors.
That's
from
people's like honest reaction.
Yeah, right. People usually out of towners, a Chicagoan who's probably hosting them says, hey, you want to try a shot of Chicago's own spirit? Sure. They try it. They make a funny face. It's called Malort face. And you can find it, hashtag Malort face. So incidentally, a great, I don't know if this cocktail has been done yet, but Cohasset Punch and Malort, Cohasset Punch on the sweeter side, Malort on the bitter side, I think those could
is
be...
Is this like the cocktail equivalent of the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup? Like two great tastes that go great together?
Yes, yes.
Greater than the sum of the parts?
Although, yeah, some people might say that Malort isn't such great taste, but I think it actually... I kind of like it. I mean, I don't have it often, but I think making it... In fact, I'm going to... This weekend, I'm going to make a cocktail with the two of them. I'll be the guy who invents the Malort Cohasset Punch.
We'll try it during the news break. I'll give my reaction. I wanted to ask you, too. So you've got... It's a good amount, you know, for the book, the 30... As far as the, you know, the different things. Did you have an idea? Because, you know, as you start to explore, certainly you have that team photo, which is a handful of things, and think, well, we'll find a few more. Did you cap it at a certain amount, or was 30 about what you thought made sense?
We actually didn't know how many we would find. I was surprised we found as many as 30. But 30 seemed like a nice round number, a good place to stop. And I'm not sure there are many other Chicago original foods out there that we didn't cover. But I've just named two that might be in the next edition, the Chicago-style hot dog croissant and the Cohasset Punch, which look for it on store shelves this spring. He said Greg Shudders is talking to distributors now to get, you know, you have to talk to somebody like Southern Wine and Spirits or whatever to get distributed in the stores. I don't know that he's talking to Southern.
I imagine how that, David, how that conversation would go. You bring it in. I'm imagining a conference room. I'm imagining, like, distributor people who are going to bring it to the places, and they try it. And they're like, this is awful. He's like, right.
With Malort. Right. Exactly. The taste we're going for.
Exactly what I want. So we are going to take a break. When we come back, you never know, you may find this, you know, the Cohasset Punch on at the tables or behind the bars at some places from Chicago Restaurant Week. So, David, we're going to be talking to some of those. Yeah.
Can I add just one other thing?
Sure.
This Friday in the Tribune, there's going to be a story written by me about Cohasset Punch and Greg Shudders and the work he's done. That's going to be online. And then on Wednesday, it'll be in the print edition. So you can check it out there if you're interested in more. What I find to be a fascinating story of a guy with a passion who found a deceased liqueur that he really loved, and he's brought it back to life for us Chicagoans.
Yeah, is it revived or is it zombie, right? Who knows? We'll find out. Liquor.